Hi, how are you doing? With an article in The Guardian today, I won't be able to talk about it until I've actually said something about the author's name. It's a woman called Gaia Vince. And because I'm a kind of, not a social cripple, I think is overstating it, but I've got a terrible tendency to have to say the thing that's at the front of my mind or I can't progress. So Gaia has written an article about love, sort of John Lennon theme, if you like. Love is all you need, or if it's not all you need, it's certainly the prerequisite before you can get anything else that you need. And being a kind of a person somewhat lacking, perhaps, in if not social graces, the things that cause other people to move through society without rubbing the further wrong direction of everybody else, I have to ask whether you think her name was always Gaia, because there are two possibilities, aren't there? Firstly, she was always called Gaia, which probably indicates a certain kind of background, or secondly, she changed her name to Gaia, which indicates a certain kind of approach to the world. But now that I've said that, I can move on. So she's written an article about the climate crisis and how it's going to be solved because of our capacity for love. Societies are built on love, she thinks. It's been selected for. We're a kind of adaptive creature. We're genetically adaptive. She doesn't mention genes, but that's what she means. Over hundreds of thousands of years, we've been genetically, biologically, and socially adaptive. And the thing that's allowed us to survive, the thing that's our unique selling point, the thing that allows us to flourish, the thing that allowed us to become top species, is this capacity for love. So the future necessary society, and of course at the moment a lot of people are paranoid about this idea of a great reset and the idea that, for example, all the small retailers have been destroyed over the last year and a half with a view to making us dependent on a few large companies. So the new necessary society, which some people think is a plan and others think is simply forced on us by events, but this new society will be founded on a new and expanded love. It's not clear whether she thinks that in actual fact all we need to do is unleash what we already have and let it have full reign in a way that perhaps it doesn't at the moment, or whether we have to do more by way of this beneficence, this hardwired tendency towards charity, whether we have to cultivate that more and expand it. But anyway, the new society will be built on love. Technology, of course, is necessary for a transition to, for example, a zero carbon world. But the technology is the thing that comes after the will to deploy it and the will to do what's necessary to make the benefits available to everybody. So while technology is key, love is no epiphenomenon. It's no irrelevance. It's core to solving the crisis. It'll save us from the warming planet, supposedly. Now, she slides between saying the crisis is a crisis in the developed economies and saying it's a crisis of the developed economies. Mainly, she says it's a crisis of the developed economies in terms of the limited capacity to do what's necessary. So, essentially, we've got problems internal to the UK and to other developed economies, and there are problems that are worldwide, and it's the developed economies that can solve all of them, and therefore there's a problem within the UK about our limited sentiments and the policies that we've got at the moment, which don't adequately protect the poor, and then there's a problem more generally of whether the developed world can do enough to roll out the technology and make all of the necessary arrangements to prevent the forthcoming crisis. So we're facing lower output and lower output of less nutritious food, supposedly. And therefore, there's going to have to be new systems in place, new global welfare systems, if you like, but new ways of producing food, microproteins, insects, and ensuring that the food's distributed and other resources are distributed so that everybody gets an adequacy. If you like, it's a bit, what she's proposing, although she doesn't say it, is something like a World War II ration system, where you take the limited resources you've got and you ensure that everybody has got enough. And this, of course, can't be based on charity. It has to be based on entitlement. So there has to be a new kind of welfare for a less productive world. And she doesn't just imply, she says it has to be rights-based. And therefore that implies, I don't know if it implies enforcement, but it certainly implies obligation on the part of the developed world. Now, she thinks that the COVID crisis has demonstrated just how dangerous inequality is in itself. As we always say, as the sort of lawyers and philosophers say, eo ipso, in and of itself. So she thinks that COVID demonstrates inequality is dangerous in and of itself, and inequality will be very dangerous come the looming environmental crisis. So while it might be a different crisis in the UK in terms of its scale and specifics, it'll still kill people. It'll kill more in the tropics and equatorial countries, but it's still a potentially lethal crisis. Some of the things in the UK are not in and of themselves lethal, but they're miserable. Like, for example, she says poorly designed houses, often built on cheaper land in floodplains with environmentally damaging and inefficient heating systems. So the absence of heat pumps, the absence of insulation, and the location of these properties is going to mean that essentially the poor might be left in isolated, vulnerable floodplains with distances to travel to access every service, while the rich will, in essence, buy dry. They'll pay for the houses that are less vulnerable. So this climate crisis will be visited on those that can least easily buy their way. It'll be visited most heavily on those least able to buy their way out of it. I'm just thinking of a friend of mine who lives in Cumbria, and the problems that people in Carlisle, for example, have got with water rushing off the hills, and how cheap houses are, uninsurable houses are dirt cheap in places that flood regularly. So there'll be an expansion of that kind of phenomena. People who can't afford to buy a house that won't be flooded once every couple of years will have to tolerate being flooded once every couple of years. Now, yesterday, Boris Johnson was criticised for saying that the Roman Empire collapsed because of unchecked immigration, people flooding into the empire from outlying provinces. And this was, at least one Glasgow councillor said this was unchecked racism. And I noticed another scholar on Twitter, an academic, was questioning whether Johnson had a handle on the real causes of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. But anyway, so Johnson was saying that he anticipates, if we don't do something radical, global migration patterns that could challenge the ability of Western governments to manage their affairs because they can't control their borders. This author, Gaia Vince, says that the migration patterns that are going to have to happen to some degree, people are going to have to move from some places, this could be used to boost economies in the West because it'll provide willing workers. So this forthcoming change in how the world runs itself, what she's talking about essentially is if not an erosion of the nation state, certainly an erosion of the idea that it's legitimate for nation states to suit themselves. So there's going to be a society where people have got a right, a global society where people have a right to health cover and shelter and food, and this is going to have to be predicated, it's going to be based on our capacity for compassion, which she thinks is, can be evidenced over hundreds of thousands of years. In the past, people with disabilities, the old, were cared for, and therefore this ability to cooperate, this ability to care, will form the basis of a future better set of social arrangements. We can transmit ideas, we can transmit culture, we can transmit language through social networks. We already know how to do that, and therefore we can build on that kind of cooperative ape capacity, if you like. The various, she characterises us as a kind of technological ape to some degree. Marx, I think, said we were sort of homo faber, sort of the ape that fabricates things. But the social ape, the ape that can organise systems and can cooperate and can has a theory of mind and has both empathy and sympathy, the ability to understand the other person's position and to have sympathy for their difficulties. All of that will allow us, she thinks, to build this future society based on that compassion, or as she characterizes it, that love. None of us could survive on our own. So human beings are vulnerable creatures. We're not great white sharks. We're not bears in the wilds of Alaska. And therefore, we have to, you know, provide a social relationship that's sustainable over time. That, she thinks, involves demanding more of governments. It's an interesting point in her argument. What she's saying is essentially there's something in our civil society, in our family. Hegel wrote a famous book, The Philosophy of Right, and he sees the political arrangements as necessary developments of the other stages or elements of what it is to be a human. We're driven, there's a kind of teleological process in place. And she thinks that essentially the political isn't fully responsive to the familial and the social and the compassionate and the ethical and the moral. So she says we have to ask more of our governments. Governments have to do more to make full use of what we are, if you like. They have to make use of the love that we're going to retrieve. She uses the word retrieve, that's the best of humanity. So this is the article, as I say, and it's interesting because it's a Guardian article, which is so Guardian it's open to parody or dismissal. I don't think it should be simply dismissed, but what worries me is that it's the kind of thing that passes for thought, and that, if it really is the case that we face a climate disaster, really won't do. The thing that's slightly irritating about all of this, particularly if you're a sort of political theorist, is that she seems to assume there's no prior art, or worse than that, she assumes that the prior art that does exist supports her position, and she doesn't bother to consider the alternatives. This idea of whether man is naturally social, this has been a running theme for at least 2,500 years in political theory, and Hobbes in 1651 references the bees. Man is not naturally social like the bees. And the reason he references that is because Aristotle talks about what kind of animals we are, and whether we are, as he says, a zoonotic and a political animal. And if we are a political animal, what kind of political animal we are. And it's interesting to talk about Aristotle, because in looking at democratic Athens and looking at the Greek city-states, Aristotle talks about the necessity of hunting for slaves. And the Golden Age of Athens was, of course, built on slavery and the appalling mistreatment of other human beings. Athens and Sparta had their enslaved populations. Opinions differ as to how many. I think every Spartan was accompanied by one helot, but the Mycenaeans were used for output because there was so little surplus available. A person had to work so hard to produce enough food for themselves to produce a surplus to keep one person who was completely idle or training militarily to be a highly effective thug. You might need 10 slaves. So opinions differ as to how many people were actually involved in creating these glorious, democratic, advanced city-states. But it was many slaves for every single free citizen, or certainly many non-citizens for every, even if you say that some of the non-citizens weren't enslaved, they were certainly lesser creatures and treated less well. So the idea that human beings have this long uninterrupted history of love and social cooperation, the only two species that seem to be prepared to hunt and kill their own kind for what looks very much like enjoyment are chimpanzees and human beings. The history of humanity is a history of limited sentiment, and the modern era, from whatever you want to pick, the 16th century onwards or whatever, but the spread towards something approaching regularity and law, of course there was Roman law, but I mean the modern era in Europe, where the violence and the feudalism was tempered by something approaching system and process and bureaucracy. Whatever period you want, whatever date you want to put in that, It's a relatively recent invention. And when Hume explains exactly why magistracy, as he puts it, and law and property are necessary, and he takes us through the limited sentiments, Hume's inquiry in morals, and he takes us through the limited sentiments that we've got, how we take pleasure in other people's pleasure, we kindle in the society of our fellow creatures. We love to see a great man's warm house and the servants who don't fear for the future because they know that he's generous and gentle and they can look forward to his guardianship and protection and so on. All of that's true, but it's also true that we favour those closest to us far more. I think humans favour their kids over themselves, and they favour their kids and themselves over almost everybody else. With a brother against a cousin, with my cousin against the world. That's the reality of human beings. If we look at Papua New Guinea, not only when it was, you know, when Western naval forces arrived, I think in the late 20s or early 30s, but if we look at Papua New Guinea, even today it's descending back into tribal warfare. Papua New Guinea, of course, had, I think, hundreds of different languages in a fairly small territory. Because you couldn't even move a small distance away from where you were recognised by the tribe or you risked being killed. There's some famous footage of a fight breaking out, I think, in Papua New Guinea. And when they went back and they analysed every single blow in this massive rolling fight, every single blow was delivered in defence of a person that the other person was more closely related to, against someone they were more distantly related to. So brothers were hitting cousins, and cousins were hitting second cousins in defence of cousins. It really was the case that when all of the social restrictions went off and all of the instincts came to the fore, it really was the case that people were tribal and familial to a really strong degree. Michael Ignatieff, in his book Blood and Belonging, talks about what happened in the former Yugoslavia. And the sequence of events was the collapse in government and the security that an abstract state provided. And then the question arises, who can I trust? And it was Croats trusting other Croats and Serbs trusting other Serbs. Noah Yuval Harari, in a recent book, Sapiens, talks about the prevalence of empire in the modern age and how empires are normal. And of course, empires were ancient as well. But what's interesting about empires is the limited provision that the empire engages in when it comes to positive things, the exact opposite of what Vince is talking about here. She's talking about things that are touched, you know, they're three-dimensional, food and shelter and so on. What empires provided was magistracy. What they provided was violence to prevent other violence. And empires worked precisely because that was all they provided. So human beings, Daniel Dennett, the philosopher, talks about this. He talks about the evolution of God as a useful constable. Because once you can prevent interpersonal violence to a fair degree by getting people to worry about the consequences for their eternal soul if they engage in it, then you've made a huge leap forward. But to try to go beyond that to the sort of positive obligations, to get people to put their hand in their pocket or to put their shoulder to the wheel and to deploy their time, because it amounts to the same thing. As Goodhart has pointed out, if we look at societies, it's only the tightly integrated ones where you get extensive welfare. The ones that are fragmented and pluralistic typically have the least tolerance for social provision and redistribution. The thing that makes a people tolerant of lots of redistribution is existential threat. So during World War II, the British Empire was hugely successful in mobilising resources. But within the UK, the tolerance of the indigenous population for all of the sacrifices and all of the new accommodations, that evaporated as soon as peace was restored. So human beings are creatures driven by love, but the whole history of it is of a particular kind of love which is entirely inconsistent with the sort of global sentiment that Vince would like to see. The reality of libido dominandi, the tendency to try to dominate other people and to try to actually impose yourself, is as clear as any general capacity towards goodwill. It's obvious that human beings are the kind of creatures that establish hierarchies very quickly, and then within the tyranny that a group will try to impose on others, you get a tyranny within the tyranny. So you get the Spartans impose themselves on the Mycenaeans, and then the Spartans impose themselves on each other. All of the evidence is that human beings are creatures that are quite dangerous. The Moriori on, was it the Chatham Islands, I think? But the Moriori were butchered by the Maori. And of course, the indigenous New Zealand population, the Maori now, want to try and recast the terrible violence visited in the Moriori because it makes them look bad. But they shouldn't really worry too much about it, because there's not much evidence that anybody anywhere has been very different. Human beings everywhere at all times have been creatures capable of violence. And the thing that makes human society stable is precisely love of a limited kind. It's not a love to all humans everywhere. Quite the opposite. It's a particular special love for your own troop, your own group. The Scots right now are trying to invent themselves as a people uniquely motivated by a sentiment that they choose to characterise as civic nationalism. Nicola Sturgeon repeatedly talks about Scots being new Scots, all those who choose to make their home here. But of course, Scotland was exactly the violent, tribal, feudal, particular, partial society where you could absolutely rely on your violent brother to defend you because against outsiders, but you couldn't trust them not to attack you for your wife as an insider. You know, the Scotland that was Malcolm Gladwell's target when he talked about the culture that was exported to Harlan, Kentucky. When he talks about the culture that still exists in the south of the United States, the feuding culture of the Scots-Irish, that's the reality of Scotland 300 years ago and more. And it's not a terrible slander on the Scots to note that, because it's the reality pretty much of anybody if you look back beyond the period of magistracy. It's the abstract modern state and the violence that it visits on people who don't recognise the state's monopoly of violence. It's that stops us being bloody awful. And the gap between not being bloody awful and being the parent to the world entire is quite a large gap. And Vince seems intent on ignoring it. Indeed, the most obvious thing you can say about her claim that love is everywhere and at all times the great powerful force in human affairs is that, well, to the extent that that's true, it's present right now. So you're counselling that we do something which you're also telling us we do without hesitation at all times and in all places. I asked somebody who was married to a Church of Scotland minister once to explain the special presence of God at communion. The Catholic Church tells us that the whole substance of the wafer and the wine becomes the body and blood of Christ at communion. The Scottish version, Scottish Presbyterian version, is that Christ is a special presence. I said to her, can you explain to me how Christ could be a special presence at communion if God is fully everywhere at all times in all places? And she said, no. But the love that Vince wants to talk about as being everywhere and at all times through human history going back hundreds of thousands of years. And of course, that implies, I think, beyond Homo sapiens, I think, to earlier versions of ourselves. That love is either present right now fully or it isn't. And therefore, if it exists at all times and all places, as she says, then what it is doing right now is mitigating the worst aspects of the crisis. Things are better now than they would be in the absence of the love that she's talking about. So that we don't have to worry about how good things can be made by deploying love, because the reason why things aren't any worse than they are right now is because love is already present. Her position is basically that love is very deep, but not so deep that it can't be different from how it is now. And that looks problematic. If we think about where we actually are with our arrangements in Britain, to take Britain as a case in noose, an example of a country that's not so very different from others, not so very different in terms of its culture, its politics, its industry, its charity, its international aid. I was looking at this morning. When we gave 0.7%, I think it was, of GDP to the developing world, we were keeping 99.3% for ourselves. Now, you can add this gross national income, gross domestic product, you should arrive at the same answer. Not everything that's produced here belongs to people here. Of course, there are companies paying dividends to foreigners and so on. But you're not so very, very far away when you say that we have about 2,000 to 2,200 billion for ourselves, and we're handing over 0.7% of that. So somewhere between 14 and 20 billion for the rest of the world. So taking these as ballpark figures, you're talking about, I think, valuing ourselves as about 20,000 of anybody else. If you think that there's 1 billion people in really severe poverty, less than $2 a day, there's 3 billion who are, by anyone's standards, extremely poor. If you take that figure of 3 billion, I think that we take the consequence of being the first industrial nation, the lucky country, if you like. Greta Thunberg tells us that that we're responsible because we were the country that invented the modern world. I don't know if we're responsible, but we were the country that invented the modern world. To take her line that we're actually liable for a wrong done is to suggest that modernity itself was a bad idea. So let's assume that the modern world was not a bad thing. And therefore, to any extent, that we're liable for damages for the wrong that we did, we're also appropriately compensated for the good that we did. So we'll net those two off together and say that we don't owe Greta anything. But nevertheless, we are the first industrial nation. And if you think that we don't, as individuals, work any harder than anybody else anywhere in the world, and therefore the difference in output that we get from our work is entirely a consequence of the lucky position that we're in, and I think that's true, then we presently value ourselves as worth 20,000 of everybody else, because we keep 99.3%, and that's before Rishi Sunak's changes. We keep even more than that now. But even at 99.3%, we were valuing ourselves as worth 20,000 of everybody else in the world. This, of course, tells us something about the sentiments of the people and the love that the people have, because the developed countries, including the United Kingdom, are democracies. And what's striking is that the attempt by parties of the radical left to win the support of the ordinary poor in the developed world, they've not had much success. And I would suggest there's a reason for that. It's because people who are not particularly well off in the West know that they're also not particularly nice. None of us are. We kid ourselves. We find it hard to actually tell the truth about our sentiments, because we look at our sentiments, or we consider the experience of our sentiments, and we ignore the evidence of our actions. So if we look at how much money we actually give to charity and hand over to good causes internationally, but in particular, because that, of course, is where you would discover yourself. If you really were as benevolent, you would discover that you're giving loads to the developed world. When you give to some charity, when former soldiers give to the British Legion, that's not quite the same thing as giving to Oxfam or Save the Children, or when sailors in coastal communities give to the RNLI, it's not quite the same thing as giving to Intermediate Technology. So if you consider the fine feelings you have, you'd consider yourself to be a tremendously generous person. But when you look at the evidence of what you actually do with your money, you discover that your sentiments are very limited. And surely that's a better piece of evidence than your feelings, because your feelings cannot possibly be as strong as you imagine them to be if they're not actually emerging in your actions. And ordinary people living in democracies, they seem to understand that they're not as nice as they would perhaps pretend, or would allow politicians to flatter them into pretending. ordinary folk do not vote for these tremendously radical redistribution policies because they think, and I think rightly, that it would be a question of geese and golden eggs. I think most of us know that a radical reordering of society would unleash the forces of selfishness that are present in everybody, that the poor are possessed of exactly the same powerful feelings of envy and resentment and laziness as the rich. We're all pretty indolent. We all find it difficult to make an effort if we could impose ourselves on somebody else. The thing that distinguishes us from the Athenian or the Spartan is that we force ourselves to recognise that there's something actually, in a kind of Kantian sense, wrong with actually trying to dominate somebody else. But if you look at the love that people have of, for example, service industries, I mean, what are restaurants really but socially acceptable ways of having slaves? If you actually look at the facial expressions of a lot of people in a restaurant, there's something slightly disgusting in it. Because there's nothing really pleasant about eating in a room full of strangers. I would imagine if you measured, and I've said this before, if you measured cortisol levels, I think most people find it stressful to eat in a room full of strangers. But the experience of being completely idle and telling others exactly what you need to be brought to your table and then having them do it, that's so deeply built into human nature. You can see it in little kids as well. If you put a little kid in a car, the first thing they'd love to do is put their elbow in the windowsill in an open window or yell at someone out the window. If you give a stupid person a car at 17 or 18, they'll take enormous delight in splashing people with water on a wet day. And that desire to impose yourself on other folk, that all too human tendency towards appalling behaviour, unless you consciously check yourself, it's there. And we're fools if we deny it. I noticed Catherine Burble Singh was criticised for making use of the notion of original sin. She was talking about how important it is to socialise school kids, and progressives everywhere were jumping on her, saying that this was disgusting to suggest that there was original sin, that we really were as appalling as some religions would tell us, that we could only be saved by grace and by a recognition of our wickedness. It strikes me as obvious that the people in the developed world who insist in living very, very good lives compared to those elsewhere, there's very little, as far as I can see, commitment to living like poor people. And even among the most vocal, and Neil Oliver pointed out that, as everybody else has seen, that there's something really nauseating about watching global leaders flying private jets to Glasgow to discuss what can be done to reduce CO2 emissions. You know, I mean, the idea that Zoom calls are for little people is so deeply embedded in their worldview that they can't even escape it for a moment. Vince is guilty of this too. I mean, this emphasis on food. It's true that there's something really appalling about hunger. And it's true that some people in the UK doubtless have enough, have great difficulty in feeding themselves. But two things jump out. Firstly, as I've said repeatedly, the UK spends enough on welfare and pensions to give 20 million people £15,000 each a year. We spend a bit over £300 billion. So we know, and we also know, that the total cash value of all the food handed out by food banks is tiny compared to the cost of the welfare state. And it's extremely unlikely that food banks would disappear if we increased welfare spending by that amount. So we know that the discourse on poverty in the UK is frankly nonsense. Now that I'm no longer a member of a political party, I don't have to pretend otherwise, thank God. And when it comes to people in the third world, I mean, this emphasis on food, it's important that people do have access to food. It's terrible if they don't. But to really focus on that indicates exactly the kind of blind spot that most people in the West have to the plight of the poor. The biblical injunction, man cannot live by bread alone, is, you know, so obvious. The plight of somebody stuck in a Syrian refugee camp who's got more than enough calories every day, is perfectly adequately fed, but has nothing to do, has no social life, has no human life, There's nothing that would actually be fit for the kind of creatures that we are. And talking about the provision of healthcare, as if the provision of healthcare was everywhere in old times the same thing, as if the £90,000 that we'll spend in the UK to give somebody 3 years of life is the same thing, in fact more than that during COVID, is the same thing as the provision of elementary or minor healthcare vaccines and antibiotics and HIV medication in sub-Saharan Africa. There's something very odd about anybody who would write an article in The Guardian and would talk about, you know, food and healthcare and shelter as if the provision of these essentials. I mean, I realise that I think it's Maslow's hierarchy. Without these things, there is nothing. But with these things, there's next to nothing. You don't begin to live a fully human life because arrangements have been made such that you don't die of starvation. And the evidence that there's a blind spot is quite extensive. Why the sudden concern with the world's poor because of the climate crisis, if there is a climate crisis, which there probably is? If for the sake of argument, the global weather patterns are highly problematic and have been causing problems for decades and are causing problems at an increasing rate, this hasn't significantly worsened the position of the poor considered globally recently compared to what it was, because economic growth in relatively poor countries has been a countervailing force in the other direction. So just as crops have become more problematic, just as fires and heat waves have become more of a problem, just as fishing communities have experienced reduced access to fishing waters and so on, and there's all these problems, it's also been the case there's been economic growth and industrialization that's lifted hundreds of millions out of poverty. So the problem of global poverty net has not increased with the climate crisis. And yet for some reason, this is now the great focus. And that indicates something. It indicates that the concern with the lot of the poor isn't what it appears to be, because it wasn't there to anything like the same intensity when the poor were far more numerous and suffering worse outcomes, albeit perhaps none of those outcomes the product of the latest changes in the climate. So that there's something guy strange, as we would say in Scotland, about this fascination with people in the Maldives seeing rise in sea levels when horrific levels of deprivation were and are present all over sub-Saharan Africa and rural India, rural China and elsewhere today and for the last 100-150 years. And to claim that COVID is a demonstration of the instinct towards care and love. I was watching Jay Bhattacharya, as I probably said before, one of the original Barrington Declaration authors, on the Hoover Institute website, talking about what we actually did during COVID. What we did during COVID was to insist that something be done, that it have a story behind it which made us feel relatively comfortable, and that it have factual provisions that made us actually comfortable. So in Scotland, nobody really cared, it seems. I mean, it seems as if the SNP have got away with it. We seeded the care homes with people who had COVID, and we killed a lot of people. We forced the bus drivers and other essential workers to go to work when they were males in their 50s, perhaps with obesity, perhaps with pre-existing health problems. And we had loads of 20-year-olds, including obviously females, who were at absolutely zero risk, or as close to zero as makes no difference, from COVID. We gave them furlough money and they stayed at home. Yesterday I noticed that a third of Scots, and in particular younger Scots, want another COVID furlough lockdown after COP26, even if there's no increase in COVID infections and there's no particular reason why they should have one. And that's because they quite enjoy being paid to stay at home. Now, you would have thought that a people concerned with the interests of others would have been at work and desperate to be at work, producing economic output that could be used to help the poor and the dispossessed here and elsewhere. But that's not how human beings operate. So when we look at the COVID response and we look for evidence that this is the playing out of this tendency to care for others, this universal love, this solvent that's going to that dissolve the thorny problem, the tricky knot of the global climate crisis, we see the exact opposite. What we actually see is the all too understandable tendency to favour ourselves over other people. Because there was little in the COVID crisis that showed any concern whatsoever for what was going to happen to the third world. In Thailand right now, the levels of poverty are off the scale because the tourist industry has collapsed, and it has been collapsed for a year and a half. And a year and a half ago, I was blue in the face trying to explain to my colleagues at the time exactly what was now going to happen in these countries where the population is young, where the risk from COVID is low, where the cost of the COVID response that the West engaged in was going to be borne. And people laughed. They actually found it funny. And Bhattacharya and the other authors of the Barrington Declaration said exactly the same thing, and they were completely ignored. So the idea that COVID and the COVID response provides evidence for this this tendency towards global sentiment, fine love for humanity considered in its entirety, provides the evidence for the exact opposite. It provides evidence for us not even caring enough about the people that we're closest to worry about it. The COVID response in Scotland consisted of people allowing their grandmother to be killed because they would then be placed in furlough. That sounds controversial, it sounds inflammatory, but there's an element of truth in it. People actually cared more about how it personally affected them, whether they lost their business, whether they would be put out of work, whether they would have money to stay at home. They cared more about that than the reality of sick people being placed in care homes and people dying of strokes and heart attacks because we closed, in effect, the non-COVID NHS. And if you think that's an inflammatory thing to say and you'd like to quote me in some newspaper or podcast, go right ahead, because it's the truth. If we actually look at the early numbers that came in the March, April, it was obvious what was happening at an early stage, but nobody was particularly bothered. There was no traction whatsoever in the 2021 May Holyrood elections in Scotland on this issue. Jean Freeman, the Health Secretary, stood down at the election and received a big payoff, and the SNP had a fantastic result. And people cared about, I spoke to hundreds of people on doorsteps, people cared about the impression that Nicola Sturgeon made at the lectern. That was the degree of their concern. Whether she seemed plausible, whether she seemed an appropriate representative for their own self-image, whether she seemed an appropriate flag bearer for those that were intended to vote for her. But when you talk to folk about the actual numbers and what it meant, the incredible number of total Scottish deaths that were in care homes, people weren't interested. And what I found interesting was that even people in the same age group as those who were dying in the care homes weren't interested. So that's the reality of love. It's very limited, and it involves a kind of a lightness. Remember that famous movie, The Unbearable Lightness of Being? I find it that the unbearable lightness of people's concept of love, the kind of schmaltz in love that gets me. There's a kind of saccharine quality to what people say, and I suppose thinking about it, I should reference the J.D. Salinger remark that just nailed it, which I always do, and I thought it was true when I read it 30 years ago, and I think it's true still. J.D. Salinger says that the one thing, in the character of Holden Caulfield in The Catcher in the Rye, that the one thing he can't stand is sitting in a movie watching some female crying her eyes out at some schmaltzy movie, and sitting in the movies, and there's a kid sitting next to her bursting for the toilet, and she won't take the kid to the toilet because she's so upset and so moved by the representation of fine sentiments in the screen. And I thought, God, isn't that true? Isn't that exactly what people are like? This love of the sort of sound of things, of the general impression, you find it across the board. Vince talks about, a guy at Vince talks about heat pumps. This is something that I've been bouncing off the walls about for the last week. You can't really get people to interest themselves in how a heat pump works. So heat pumps have been the tripping off the lips of every politician for the last few weeks in the run-up to COP, and they're still Boris Johnson's go-to technology when he talks. A heat pump, particularly an air source heat pump, which is what they're going to try and use in urban areas, a heat pump is an air conditioning unit running in reverse. And what you're doing is you're taking heat out of the natural environment and you're trying to concentrate it, because there's a difference between heat and temperature, obviously. So you could blow lots of air into your house from outside and you'd be frozen stiff. But there's lots of heat in the air outside, so you could strip the heat out of it and then blow hot air into your house, smaller volumes. Now, as soon as you realize that that's how a heat pump works, you begin to understand why you're going to have to move a lot of air to get significant quantities of heat out of the heat pump. And given that the heat pump itself involves loads of electrical components and a motor, you know that you're going to have to put energy in to get some of this energy out. The energy in the heat is going to be scavenged from the environment by you using electricity to draw huge quantities of cold air into the heat pump and then strip the remaining heat out of it and pump even colder air back out into your street, where it will fall and freeze the street because the cold air being denser than the other air will fall. So you know that's how a heat pump works. And I noticed a Labour peer in the Herald who's been fitting, his company has been fitting these units in ground source heat pumps as well. He's been fitting these for 35 years. And he says, "I would love any member of the government to tell me exactly how they think urban heating using air source heat pumps is going to work, because it's complete nonsense from start to finish. The numbers just don't add up. You can do it in the back of an envelope." And I knew this years ago when I spoke to an electrician about this, about someone who knew how the systems worked. And it's an example, a small example perhaps, but it's an example of how we don't really have any tolerance for the details. We can't really be bothered listening to somebody who's a dissenter. Thinking about it, the Gaia Vince article is in the Guardian, and my response wouldn't be, precisely because she's in inverted commas, positive. She's saying something positive. And of course, the most positive thing that someone can say is something which is accurate and negative. The person who tells you that the forests are full of Malaysian pit vipers is the person who tells you how to avoid being killed by a Malaysian pit viper. The person who tells you about their jungle trekking company and how the great plans they've got for it is being positive. But the person who's helpful is the person that tells you about the downside. And the trouble is that we don't really think like that. Especially, interestingly, I think, North Americans. The idea that you have to be optimistic and positive is so deeply built into American culture. I don't know if this is true of Canadians to the same extent, but it seems to be true of Americans, that if you actually are a dissenting voice, then you're seen to be rebarbative and knuckle-dragging and right-wing and not appropriate. We seem to have absorbed some of that from our cousins. And in this climate crisis, the boosterism of someone like Boris Johnson talking about heat pumps and huge amounts of money being spent trying to get people to convert their properties to heat pumps, you can see the disaster coming a mile away. And the physics of it is Nat 5 physics. You can sit with an old envelope and a pencil and demonstrate to your own satisfaction that none of this can work. But that won't stop us spending hundreds of billions, because spending hundreds of billions is positive. The same can be said about the idea that there's a huge amount to be gained from taking migrants from drought and flood-prone parts of the world and using them as a labour force in the developed countries. Look at the reality of trying to make willing workers and successful, efficient workers of our indigenous population. Look at what a bad job we do right now, trying to get people through our school system and out into the wider community, where they'll become highly productive and pay taxes and put a low demand on state services. We can't even do that with the people who have got every single cultural advantage having been brought up in this country. What are the chances of somebody who might be not able to speak English, maybe illiterate in their own language, and possessed of a very different set of assumptions and a different culture? What are the chances of that person coming to a developed country like the UK, where state services cost £11,000 per person per year, and that person earning enough to cover the cost of the services they themselves receive and then contribute something else? A moment's thought causes you to think that that's probably quite unlikely, and it is quite unlikely. As I've said before, apparently an Afghan asylum seeker or refugee who's illiterate in his own language will take 10 years before he can function, 10 years teaching, before he can function in a routine job, because it's so difficult to begin to learn a language when you haven't got a language of your own to build on. And the gloomy worldview of people like me who criticised the Brandt Report back in the 1980s for its breezy optimism regarding the industrialisation of sub-Saharan Africa, it wasn't appreciated in the 1980s, this pessimism about what was achievable, and it isn't appreciated now. But of course, famously, a pessimist is what an optimist calls a realist. We do transmit culture and knowledge through generations. And right now, we're looking at a situation where a war could easily break out in the South China Sea. China could easily invade Taiwan. Poland has just, I think, doubled its military spending for fear of a conflict with the Russian Federation. And we've got all our other environmental and COVID-related problems to deal with. So while it's true that there's a compassion that runs through human nature, and while it's true that we are the creatures of language and culture and ideas and science, and we transmit that to others, we're already doing that right now, and probably to the best extent we can right now. I think it was Rilke who said that the world is the best of all possible worlds, and everything in it is a necessary evil. And that thought shouldn't make you too gloomy, because you can also argue that we're learning slowly, in Barack Obama's sense, the arc of the universe curving towards justice. We're learning slowly what does and doesn't work. And one of the things that we should have learned by now that doesn't work, we should have learned that Panglossian, breezy, generous, sentimental, hopeful optimism of the kind that that Gaia would serve us, it doesn't work. It doesn't withstand contact with the enemy. And the enemy is us. We're just not as nice as we would like to pretend. Peace.